There are no explosives involved in this interception. This is where the akin to shooting a bullet with a bullet statement applies. There are significant problems. We know from the history of the Interceptor program that its highly scripted tests have been riddled with failure. In missile defense terms, this means a disastrous success rate. In 2017, the tests plummeted to below a 40% success rate. Perhaps embarrassed by what it called design flaws, the Missile Defense Agency announced it was giving the Kill Vehicle program a strategic pause, that the agency would instead focus on a new system it calls Next Generation. But as of 2024, all 44 interceptors remain on ready for launch status, despite the unacceptable flaws. The clock is ticking. Interception by the exo-atmospheric kill vehicle is attempted. The system fails. In immediate succession, a second kill vehicle from a second interceptor missile seeks the target and fails. Ground-based interceptors are not employed in what is known as a shoot-look-shoot type of profile. There isn't enough time. The sequence is immediately followed by a third, then a fourth attempt. All four interceptor missiles have failed to stop the attacking North Korean ICBM. In the words of one critic, former Assistant Secretary of Defense and U.S. Chief Weapons Evaluator Philip Coyle, "If you miss by an inch, you miss by a mile." The die is cast. The time has come. The president must act. 10 minutes, the White House, Washington, D.C. The president was en route from a White House dining room to a command center beneath the West Wing when he was redirected to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, a more hardened facility under the East Wing. This bunker, known as the PEOC, was designed during World War II as a place to hide President Roosevelt should enemy forces penetrate U.S. air defense systems and bomb Washington, D.C. with attacking aircraft. The PEOC is a location made famous in the weeks after 9/11 because it is where Secret Service agents took Vice President Dick Cheney in the heat of the moment after the national security apparatus realized America was under terrorist attack. It was from inside this fortified operations center that the vice president was able to override the official national command structure and assume control of U.S. military assets, including fighter jets. Guiding American decisions about nuclear war are a series of procedures and protocols laid out in highly, highly, highly classified documents, former STRATCOM commander General Robert Keeler tells us. But America, the democracy, also releases information to the public, command structure and nuclear inventory included. From the unclassified Nuclear Matters Handbook 2020, a Defense Department reference manual, much can be discerned. A military command hierarchy follows strict rules. Each person carries out orders based on orders received from another person within the chain of command. Orders are delivered from the top down. Drawn as a diagram, the military chain of command resembles a pyramid of power. There are lots of people at the bottom. The president, as commander-in-chief, sits at the top. The U.S. president, as odd as this may seem, has sole authority to launch America's nuclear weapons. The president asks permission of no one, not the Secretary of Defense, not the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, not Congress. In 2021, the Congressional Research Service published a review to confirm that the decision to launch nuclear weapons is the president's and the president's alone. The authority is inherent in his role as commander-in-chief, the research found. The president does not need the concurrence of either his or her military advisors or the U.S. Congress to order the launch of nuclear weapons. With the red impact clock counting down minutes and seconds until the incoming nuclear missile strikes its target inside the United States, the time has come for the president to launch a nuclear counterattack. This will get the blue impact or counterattack clock running. On occasion, a debate arises as to whether America actually has a launch on warning policy, that the commander-in-chief really is expected to launch nuclear weapons while America is still under threat of nuclear attack, though not yet physically hit. Former Secretary of Defense Perry sets the record straight. "We have a launch on warning policy," he says, period, full stop. In this scenario, the president's advisors rush to brief him on counterattack options to get the blue impact clock running. With the briefing underway, the six-minute deadline for deliberation has begun. The president has just 6 minutes to deliberate and make a decision regarding what nuclear weapons to use and what enemy targets to instruct STRATCOM to strike. In the words of former launch control officer and nuclear weapons expert Dr. Bruce Blair, a 6 minute deadline for deliberation and decision is ridiculous, meaning nothing can prepare a man for this. It's too little time. And yet, this is exactly where we are. Standing beside the president in the PEOC is a military aide, known colloquially as the mill aide, carrying the president's emergency satchel, a handheld aluminum and leather bag, also known as the football. This leather satchel is with the president at all times. Once, when President Clinton was visiting Syria, President Hafez al-Assad's handlers tried to prevent Clinton's mill aide from riding in an elevator with him. "We could not let that happen and did not let that happen," former Secret Service Director Louis Merletti tells us. Merletti was the special agent in charge of President Clinton's detail at the time. He later became director of the U.S. Secret Service. "The football must always be with the president," Merletti clarifies. "There are no exceptions." Inside the football are papers that are arguably the single most highly classified set of documents in the United States government. Called Presidential Emergency Action Documents, PEDS, they are executive orders and messages that can be put into effect the moment an emergency scenario like a nuclear attack comes to pass. They are designed to implement extraordinary presidential authority in response to extraordinary situations, reports the Brennan Center for Justice. PEDS are classified secret, and no PED has ever been declassified or leaked. Where did this extraordinary presidential authority come from? The early history of the football has long been shrouded in mystery. Los Alamos National Laboratory declassified its origin story for this book. History lesson number 5, the president's football. One day in December 1959, a small group of officials from the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy visited a NATO base in Europe to examine joint custody nuclear bomb protocols. The NATO pilots there flew Republic F-84F jets, Operation Reflex Action was in effect, meaning air crews were ready to strike predetermined targets in the Soviet Union in less than 15 minutes from the call to nuclear war. One of the men on the visit was Harold Agnew, a scientist with a unique history. Agnew was one of the three physicists assigned to fly on the Hiroshima bombing mission as a scientific observer. He carried a movie camera with him and took the only existing film footage of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima as seen from the air. Now, in 1959, Agnew was at Los Alamos overseeing thermonuclear bomb tests. He later became the lab's director. During the trip to the NATO base, Agnew noticed something that made him wary. "I observed four F-8, 4F aircraft sitting on the end of a runway. Each was carrying two MK-7 nuclear gravity bombs," he wrote in a document declassified in 2023. What this meant was that custody of the MK-7s was under the watchful eye of one very young U.S. Army private armed with an M1 rifle and 8 rounds of ammunition. Agnew told his colleagues, "The only safeguard against unauthorized use of an atomic bomb was this single GI surrounded by a large number of foreign troops on foreign territory with thousands of Soviet troops just miles away." Back in the United States, Agnew contacted a project engineer at Sandia Laboratories named Don Cotter and asked, "If we could insert an electronic lock in the bomb's firing circuit, that could prevent just any passerby from arming the MK-7. Cotter got to work. He put together a demonstration of a device, a lock, and coded switch that functioned as follows. A 3-digit code would be entered, a switch was thrown, the green light extinguished, and the red light illuminated, indicating the arming circuit was live. Agnew and Cotter went to Washington, D.C. to demonstrate this locking device, first to the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, then to the president's top science advisor, and finally to the president himself. "We presented it to President Kennedy, who ordered it be done," Agnew recalled. The military objected. The man in charge of nuclear weapons at the time, General Alfred D. Starbird, opposed the idea. Glenn McDuff, who co-authored with Agnew the now declassified paper on the subject, summed up the general's documented concerns. "How is a pilot, U.S. or foreign, somewhere around the world, going to get a code from the President of the United States to arm a nuclear weapon before being overrun by a massively superior number of Soviet troops?" For the U.S. military, the locking device issue opened Pandora's box. "If gravity bombs were coded," McDuff explains, "why not all nuclear weapons, including missile warheads, atomic demolition munitions, torpedoes, all of them?" The president decided they needed to be. The answer came in the creation of the football, the president's emergency satchel. During Agnew and Cotter's meeting with President Kennedy, the original PSYOP was in its final stages, the plan that gave the president, not the military, control of America's nuclear arsenal. This new device, called a permissive action link, or PAL, would now be part of the new system of control. With the invention of the football, the order to launch nuclear weapons, and the ability to physically arm them would come from only the president, the commander-in-chief. "This is how the president got the football," said Agnew. 10:30, the White House, Washington, D.C. The president stares at the football. Inside this emergency satchel is a set of documents known as the Black Book, a list of nuclear strike options that a U.S. president must choose from to commence nuclear war. From a declassified but heavily redacted document, PSYOP briefing for the Nixon administration, we know this set of documents has, for decades, been called the Decisions Handbook. Details of some of the other items contained in the football have been leaked. These details include what nuclear weapons to use, what targets to hit, estimated casualties that will result. The nuclear weapons at the president's disposal in this scenario astound even him. Even more so is the truly perilous policy known as Hair Trigger Alert. Hair Trigger Alert works in concert with Launch On Warning, so as to guarantee the annihilation of a devious enemy who defies deterrence and strikes another nuclear-armed nation in a decapitation event. U.S. nuclear forces maintain an arsenal of weapons on so-called Hair Trigger Alert, also known as Ready for Launch status. This means the president has the ability to order the launch of 1, 10, 100, or all of America's nuclear weapons at his or her choosing, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. All he has to do is follow the directions inside the football. Which brings us to the U.S. nuclear triad, the triptych of nuclear weapons the president has the authority to launch by land, by air, and by sea. The U.S. nuclear triad includes on land, 400 ICBMs, each carrying one warhead. In the air, 66 nuclear-capable bombers, B-52 bombers and B-2 stealth bombers, each carrying multiple nuclear warheads. At sea, 14 nuclear-armed submarines, each carrying multiple submarine-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs, outfitted with multiple nuclear warheads. The 100 tactical nuclear bombs at NATO bases in Europe are not officially considered part of the triad. The time has come for the president to make a decision. In this scenario, nuclear weapons are about to be launched by the U.S. for the first time since World War II. The mill aide opens the football in front of him. The president stares at the black book. Stratcom commander, sir. No one but the most senior level officials in U.S. nuclear command and control ever sees the contents of the black book. The number of people who have written about what they've seen is extremely limited. The targets involved, what kind of weapons would be used, kilotonnage versus megatonnage, the mass casualty numbers that will result. John Rubel is one of them. Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers fame is another. Ted Postal and John Wolfsall are among the individuals who have seen the contents of the Black Book, but have never shared what they learned. What is detailed in the Black Book is a secret most men take to their graves, perhaps for reasons like the ones Rubel shared with us before he died. President Clinton's military aide, a colonel named Robert Buzz Patterson, once likened the Black Book to a Denny's breakfast menu. He made the analogy that choosing retaliatory targets from a predetermined nuclear strike list was as simple as deciding on a combination of food items at a restaurant, like picking one out of column A and two out of column B. Los Alamos historian and nuclear weapons engineer Dr. Glenn McDuff has never seen the Black Book himself, but knows many who have. It's called the Black Book because it involves so much death, McDuff says. A flurry of voices shout at the president, everyone vying for his attention. The president says aloud to no one in particular, "Quiet." 11 minutes, National Military Command Center, Pentagon. Beneath the Pentagon, inside the National Military Command Center, the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff face the President on satellite video comms. It is 3:14 p.m. Federal employees are still at work. This presents a for better or for worse situation for the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman. On the one hand, the president's two most important advisors in a nuclear crisis are immediately available to him for advice. On the other hand, these two individuals are standing under one of the two likely targets. If they remain where they are and the nuclear weapon strikes Washington, D.C., they will be killed. The president focuses his attention on the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Tell me what to do. It's a natural thing to say. No one but a madman would want to launch nuclear weapons of their own accord. The chairman tells the president that he, as chairman, is part of the chain of communication, not the chain of command, for authorizing a nuclear launch. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff gives advice, not orders. Advise me, the president commands. Seconds pass. The chairman briefs the president on the situational awareness that's been developed, on counterstrike options, on what needs to happen next. There is an actual script that the president will be walked through, former special assistant to the president, John Wolfsthal, tells us. It is literally written down. And the lead officer from the National Military Command Center will walk him through it. There are just a few minutes remaining for him to order a counterstrike, the chairman says. But before the president can launch nuclear weapons, he must move the status of forces to Defense Readiness Condition 1, maximum readiness, immediate response, prepare for nuclear war. The military has never been raised to DEFCON 1, at least not as far as the public has been made aware. During the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, U.S. forces were placed at DEFCON 2, meaning war involving nuclear weapons was presumed to be imminent. Okay, fine, move to DEFCON 1, says the president. Then, to the Secretary of Defense, wild-eyed, almost frantic now, he says out loud what he is thinking privately, what no one else dares to say. Is this even real? Chairman, yes. President, good God. Secretary of Defense, cautious. We are waiting for more information to come in. What do we do? The president wonders. And here is where advice and options can dangerously diverge. Hold, the Secretary of Defense in this scenario says, and advises the president to consult with his counterparts in Russia and China first. SecDef, we must gather information, Mr. President. The gathering of information decreases the likelihood of making a catastrophic mistake. The president's national security advisor remains preoccupied. Getting North Korea on the phone has failed. Now he's working to get Moscow on the line. From satellite comms in the Nebraska bunker, the STRATCOM commander disagrees with the SecDef. An enemy is attacking the homeland with a nuclear weapon, sir, he says, emphasis on nuclear. The president requests information from the casualty officer. We are looking at hundreds of thousands of casualties in D.C. alone, the casualty officer says. The chairman corrects that number. It will be upwards of 1 million, Mr. President, sir. STRATCOM commander, launch on warning allows us to change their decision calculus, sir. We retaliate to decapitate, says the chairman, acting now in a manner colloquially known as jamming the president, whereby generals and admirals pressure the president to quickly launch nuclear weapons while the U.S. is still under suspicion of attack. But the SecDef is adamant, "No, Mr. President, we must wait," which is when the SecDef clarifies his comments with what everyone fears, but no one else dares to say. SecDef, "To launch now all but guarantees a wider war." 12 minutes, Stratcom headquarters, Nebraska. In the bunker beneath Offutt Air Force Base, the Stratcom commander stands facing the president and his mill aide on video comms. The time has come to discuss and finalize nuclear options. As the president's mill aide was opening the football in the bunker beneath the White House, a similar action was taking place here at Stratcom, inside its bunker, the battle deck. A black safe in this nuclear operations center contains an identical copy of the president's nuclear decisions handbook, the Black Book. The Black Book inside the president's football and our Black Book are duplicates. Former Stratcom Battlewatch commander Colonel Carolyn Byrd told CNN, and that the two books contain the same information in the same way, so that we are talking off the same documents when we are discussing nuclear options. Nuclear options. The time has come to act. Standing beside the Stratcom commander is the nuclear strike advisor, an individual whose job it is to study the contents of the Black Book on a daily basis. Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Geelan once served in this position. To explain the macabre complexity of his job, Geelan uses language that only touches the surface. "My responsibility as the Stratcom nuclear strike advisor," Geelan told 60 Minutes, "is to be the expert on the nuclear decisions handbook and the alert status of all U.S. nuclear forces." All U.S. nuclear forces refers to the triptych of sea, air, land nuclear weapons, the 400 ICBMs, the 66 nuclear-capable bombers, and the 14 nuclear-armed subs. Standing beside the nuclear strike advisor in the Stratcom bunker is the weather officer, whose job it is to brief the president on how many people will likely die from nuclear fallout after a U.S. counterstrike. It's a ghastly job, one that requires math and accounting skills to calculate and report accurate and thus astonishingly high number death tolls. During the 1960 nuclear strike plan against Moscow, as relayed to us by John Rubel, the nuclear fallout numbers in China alone included half the population of China. Today, that would mean more than 700 million Chinese citizens would be dead from radiation poisoning after a nuclear strike on Russia. The Stratcom commander briefs the president on his launch on warning options, presented in the Black Book as Alpha, Beta, and or Charlie options. Choices based on Stratcom's promise to deliver a decisive response if deterrence fails. According to Missile Launch Officer Bruce Blair, who died in 2020, there are approximately 80 targets in North Korea, in categories that include its nuclear war sustaining industry and its leadership. The president stares at the Black Book. The Stratcom commander has eyes on the red impact clock, the nuclear fuse getting shorter by the second. Stratcom commander, "Mr. President, we are awaiting your orders." Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, "Advise strike option Charlie." National Security Advisor, "Why would anyone be so goddamn stupid as to start a nuclear war?" The STRATCOM commander focuses on getting the blue impact clock ticking. Emphasis on military targets, sir. The Secretary of Defense is desperately trying to get his counterpart in Moscow on his phone. It is insanity for us to launch without informing Moscow, the SecDef warns. STRATCOM commander, Mr. President, sir. SecDef, don't do it, not yet. Then, who's calling China? Chairman, we are ready for your orders, sir. National Security Advisor, North Korea has nuclear facilities in a ring around Pyongyang, where nearly 3 million civilians reside. Reading from the Black Book, the president considers his options. He focuses on option Charlie, as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs suggests. The chairman clarifies numerous military targets in North Korea, in Pyongyang, Yongbyon, Yongjo-ri, Sungnam-ri, Tongchong-ri, Sin-o-ri, Masud-on-ri, Pyongsang, Sinpo, Pakchon, Suncheon, and Hyung-yi-ri. The National Security Advisor's deputy has China on the line. North Korea's Tongchang-ri missile launch complex is less than 40 miles from the border city of Dandong, population 2.2 million Chinese, someone says. STRATCOM commander to the president. Deploy 6 bombers over the peninsula. Move submarines into position around the globe. Nuclear weather officer to SecDef. The fallout estimate on Option Charlie is 400,000 to 4 million Chinese nationals. Secretary of Defense. Still no Moscow on the line. National Security Advisor. Pungji-ri is roughly 200 miles from Vladivostok, Russia, population 600,000. Vladivostok is home to the Russian Pacific Fleet, with dozens of surface warships stationed there. The red impact clock indicates 21 minutes remain until a nuclear bomb destroys Washington, D.C. We can't reach the Kremlin, says the SecDef, still on hold, which is not implausible. In November 2022, after a Russian missile was incorrectly reported to have struck NATO territory in Poland, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, was unable to reach his Russian counterpart for more than 24 hours. My staff was unsuccessful in getting me linked up with General Gerasimov, Milley conceded during a press conference a day and a half after the incident. Aides everywhere across the National Military Command Center floor are frantically dialing the U.S.-Russia deconfliction hotline, a communication link set up to avoid military misunderstanding between the two nuclear-armed superpowers. National Security Advisor, phone in hand. China says killing Chinese citizens with radiation poisoning is an act of war. Everyone on comms talking over one another. Someone says, shh. The commander of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command speaks up for the first time. There are 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea, sir. U.S. servicemen and women who are at risk, not only from lethal radiation from any U.S. nuclear counterattack on Pyongyang, but also from a counter-counterattack by North Korea. All eyes are on the president. The STRATCOM commander awaits orders, with 150,000 individuals beneath him also waiting on the president's command. No one can or will take action until the president chooses a nuclear strike option from the Black Book. We are waiting, sir, the STRATCOM commander repeats. The president hesitates. He flips a page in the Black Book, his eyes darting across numbers, letters, words. Get the bombers up, he says as he reads. U.S. nuclear-armed bombers are the only leg of the triad that can be recalled. Chairman and SecDef simultaneously, send the bombers now. The scramble alert is sounded, but everyone is acutely aware of the timing involved. U.S. bombers are not deployed with their nuclear weapons on board. Loading them takes time. President, how can we be sure this is not some kind of electronic simulation? Stratcom Commander, multiple early warning systems confirm launch. President, a spoof designed to trick me into launching nuclear weapons in error. A 21st century version of the VHS simulation tape William Perry saw in 1979. Chairman, we are certain this is very real, sir. Stratcom Commander, we need to get the blue impact clock running. Chairman, now. Everyone is watching the avatar of an ICBM making its way over the North Pole. And we know there's a nuclear warhead inside? The president asks. A fair question. The answer from the SecDef. We don't. President, what? Stratcom Commander, there is no way of certifying what's inside an ICBM warhead until after it explodes. President, what if there is no nuclear warhead inside? Imagine starting a nuclear war by mistake. Chairman, you don't launch an ICBM at the United States unless you expect to be counterattacked. President, but what if? Stratcom Commander, the warhead could be a chemical or a biological weapon. President, so we don't know. SecDef, we don't know. Stratcom Commander, sir, the gold codes. Chairman, sir, now. The president reaches into his wallet for the laminated nuclear codes card he must carry with him at all times. The biscuit, in national security terms. Wallet in hand, he begins to pull out the card. As he does, the PIOX vault doors fly open. 10 men armed with SR-16 gas-operated air-cooled carbines and AR-15 assault rifles burst into the room. They rush the president and grab him by the armpits, his feet no longer touching the ground. 12 minutes 30 seconds, Anderson Air Force Base, Guam. 8,000 miles from Washington, D.C., at Anderson Air Force Base, on the Micronesian island and U.S. territory of Guam, two B-2 stealth bombers prepare to roll out of a hangar and onto the runway. This is not a test flight. The B-2 is a $2 billion, 172-foot-long flying wing that carries in its weapons bay up to 16 nuclear bombs. Traveling at 628 miles per hour, a B-2 flies 6,000 miles without refueling. There are 20 in the fleet, based out of Whiteman Air Force Base in Missouri, with individual aircraft deploying to bases around the world, including ones in Iceland, the Azores, and in Diego Garcia. Flying out of Guam, it will take a B-2 bomber roughly 3 hours to get within striking distance of Pyongyang. So much can happen in 3 hours of nuclear war. The B-2 uses stealth technology to penetrate enemy air defenses without being seen by radar. It is the only long-range, nuclear-capable U.S. aircraft able to perform this feat. Each B-2 has a crew of two, a pilot in the left seat, a commander in the right. The B-2 carries the B-61 Mod 12 thermonuclear gravity bomb, also known as a nuclear bunker buster because of its earth-penetrating component which makes it more effective at destroying deeply buried targets. Targets like the bunkers that North Korea's supreme leader is presently suspected to be hiding inside. The main advantage of the B-61-12 is that it packs all the gravity bomb capabilities against all the targeting scenarios into one bomb, nuclear weapons expert Hans Christensen tells us. That spans from very low-yield tactical clean use with low fallout to more dirty attacks against underground targets. The B-2 stealth bomber is the most expensive aircraft in history and the most effective. But what the generals in the Pentagon know, and no one really wants to say, is that loading nuclear weapons onto the aircraft takes time. Coupled with the requisite flight time, by the time the B-2s get anywhere near Pyongyang in a scenario such as this, a general nuclear war will be well underway. Which also means that by the time the $2 billion stealth aircraft needs fuel, given where the B-2 bomber is going, there will be nowhere to refuel and nowhere to land. 13 minutes, Mount Weather, Virginia. The administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency is being driven along Highway 267 toward Dulles Airport to catch a flight when his driver is notified by the Department of Homeland Security to pull over and wait for a FEMA search and rescue team. The team is just minutes away from the FEMA chief's location and will pick him up along the side of the road. The White House is invoking the program. As chief of FEMA, he will be taken by helicopter to the Mount Weather Emergency Operations Center, as is protocol. The highway pickup is but one element of nuclear crisis protocols that were first put in place back in the early days of the Cold War. In the 1950s, President Eisenhower created the U.S. highway system with this kind of dual use in mind. He modeled America's original national system of interstate and defense highways after the superlative system of German Autobahn, he wrote in his presidential memoirs. Not only could U.S. highways facilitate large-scale evacuation of cities in a nuclear war, but the broad, flat, interstate lanes could be used as runways for takeoff and landings on bombing runs. For setting down a helicopter in the median strip or along the side of the road in the grass. This is how many of America's mid-century transportation systems were designed. FEMA is the government entity assigned to prepare for nuclear war. Its special access programs are highly classified. They also hide or obscure a misperception. The truth is, there is no federal agency to help citizens survive a nuclear war per se. What FEMA does is focus on how to save specific government officials in the event of a nuclear attack. This is part of a classified FEMA program built upon classified information called the Continuity of Operations Plan, or COOP, the program in government speak. This is not to be confused with the Continuity of Government program, former FEMA director Craig Fugate clarifies. There is the continuity of government, and then there is the continuity of operations plan, Fugate explains. Continuity of government is the constitutional succession of the acting president and agency heads. The continuity of operations program is the essential functions list that agencies are required to identify and to be able to reconstitute or reconstruct those essential functions on a very bad day. As for what constitutes a very bad day, Fugate says that's the euphemism for nuclear war. The job of FEMA after the invocation of the program boils down to a basic, terrifying concept. Can you keep enough of the government intact? Fugate asks rhetorically. The continuity program is built around low probability, high consequence events, he tells us. And it's built around this concept of no matter how bad something is, including a full-blown nuclear exchange, can the government continue to function in a lawful manner? That's what we at FEMA are shooting for. Separate from the continuity program is another program called Population Protection Planning. This involves FEMA organizing first responders to help U.S. citizens in the aftermath of an emergency crisis like a hurricane, a flood, or an earthquake. But a nuclear war is what FEMA calls a bolt out of the blue attack. If it's a bolt out of the blue attack, says Fugate, population protection planning is a different animal. With a bolt out of the blue attack, population protection planning won't happen because everyone will be dead. In this scenario, the FEMA chief's driver pulls the vehicle over to the side of the road as instructed. The helicopter carrying the FEMA search and rescue team lands in the grass. The FEMA chief boards the rotary wing aircraft and takes off. The vehicle he was driven in idles by the side of the road. People stare briefly, accustomed as they are to government vehicles showing up in and around D.C. Some take photographs, post them on social media, get back to their own lives. After a little rubbernecking, traffic moves along again. Flying now to Mount Weather, the FEMA chief joins the satellite comms. Extraordinary challenges lie ahead, he understands. In a nuclear attack, from the time we get a detection of something nuclear happening, Fugate tells us, everything becomes about counting down, looking at the time frame. In a nuclear attack, I'm looking at 15 minutes, Fugate says. So the question becomes, how fast can you move? How fast can you spin up? Because when things are moving so fast, miscalculations and mistakes take place. In a scenario such as this, a well-informed FEMA chief like Fugate suspects that the world is about to end. From this moment forward, the job of the FEMA chief is to stay focused on the program. Everything else must be ignored. You'd have to get over the fact that after a nuclear strike, you couldn't do anything for most people, Fugate warns. He says that if someone in his position were to focus on the reality of what is about to go down in a bolt out of the blue nuclear attack, you'd be paralyzed, he opines. It's almost like you'd have to disassociate yourself from the horrors. Our line of work is low probability, high consequence events. I mean, we plan for asteroids. The FEMA chief knows to prepare for the worst. And short of an asteroid hitting planet Earth, there is nothing more catastrophic than a nuclear attack. Fugate reasons, after the attack, the first question you have to ask is what's left and who's left. Then you must focus on how do you keep them alive? From there, it will get far, far worse. In the hours and days after a nuclear attack, it really now becomes about the survival, Fugate predicts. This isn't about getting back to normal. This isn't about traditional response. This is about what can we, FEMA, do to keep the most of us that have survived the initial attack alive. And the truth is, he says, The best the federal government could do is to tell people, people who still have a radio, what they can do for themselves to self-survive. Things like stock water, drink Pedialyte, stay indoors, don't forget your morals. Self-survive. 14 minutes. The White House, Washington, D.C. The heavily armed men who just entered the Presidential Emergency Operations Center are members of the Counter-Assault Team, or CAT, the Secret Service's paramilitary unit. They've been called here by the special agent in charge of the president's detail, also known as the SAC, who also ordered the Element, a three-man emergency CAT team. They're here to move the president to a secure location outside Washington, D.C. The CAT element took longer than usual to show up. This is because the special agent in charge instructed them to pass by the White House headquarters office to get whatever parachutes were there and to bring them to the PEOC. Nighthawk 1, Secret Service code for Marine 1, is not equipped with parachutes, and the SAC's job is to always be thinking ahead. When the CAT element arrives, the SAC is on his phone calling for a status update on NECAP, Secret Service code for a doomsday plane when carrying POTUS, which is the acronym for President of the United States. The element rushes to the president, dressed in black, wearing helmets and night vision goggles, ammoed up and with secure comms. The CAT operators grab the president by his arms and pull him to his feet. They are here to move POTUS, not to discuss or debate. In 19 minutes, a nuclear weapon will strike D.C. The president must board Marine One and evacuate the White House complex in 4 minutes, or Nighthawk One risks being too close to ground zero when the bomb detonates. A host of deadly threats loom, including getting knocked out of the sky from the shockwave blast and the ensuing several hundred mile per hour winds. But most concerning to the SAC are the potentially catastrophic effects from nuclear EMP, or electromagnetic pulse, a fast three-phase burst of current that can destroy Marine One's electronic systems and cause the helicopter to crash. The counter-assault team element brought parachutes to tandem jump POTUS out of the aircraft if the pilot cannot get them out of the danger zone before the red clock zeroes out. SAC, out to the south lawn, we are moving you now, sir. Over video comms, the STRATCOM commander challenges the move. STRATCOM commander, we need launch orders first, Mr. President. Chairman concurs. I advise Charlie option, sir. STRATCOM requires gold codes. SAC, we are moving POTUS now. STRATCOM commander, we require launch orders from POTUS first. Chairman, orders for EAMs, sir. EAMs are emergency action messages, coded nuclear launch orders that get transmitted to battlefield commanders around the world. National Security Advisor, the only way we don't start World War III is to wait and see if we physically get hit. Chairman disagrees. You have a duty to launch on attack, sir. SecDef to SAC, get POTUS out, take him to Site R. We are moving POTUS, says the special agent in charge. The mill aide closes the football. He locks the satchel and begins to move, always maintaining an arm's length from the president, as trained. 15 minutes, National Military Command Center, Pentagon. Inside the National Military Command Center beneath the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense is hyper-focused on an issue secondary to launch, namely continuity of government. holding one of only two civilian positions in the military chain of command, as he does, the Secretary of Defense is seriously concerned about keeping the federal government functioning in the aftermath of a nuclear attack. When a nuclear bomb hits Washington, D.C., chaos will grip the nation. Without a functioning government, there will be no rule of law. Democracy will be replaced by anarchy. Moral constructs will disappear. Murder, mayhem, and madness will prevail. In the words of Nikita Khrushchev, the survivors will envy the dead. Continuity of government, if implemented correctly, allows the president and his advisors to direct the U.S. military to fight a full-scale nuclear war from inside a backup command post like the Pentagon's alternate National Military Command Center outside D.C., colloquially known as the Raven Rock Mountain Complex, or Site R. This underground command center is located 70 miles northwest of the White House, near Blue Ridge Summit, Pennsylvania. It is considered to be the safest underground bunker in closest proximity to the White House. Now, with just minutes remaining on the safe escape clock, the Secretary of Defense considers evacuating to Site R2. He turns to his deputy chief of staff. "Is there an Osprey on the helipad?" he asks. 16 minutes, battle deck, STRATCOM headquarters, Nebraska. The STRATCOM commander is furious. He stares into the White House Presidential Emergency Operations Center via satellite comms. He sees the advisors and the aides, the officers and the deputies, but not POTUS. How can the President of the United States not be available for the STRATCOM commander in this DEFCON 1 posture? How dare the Secret Service do what they've done? "I need POTUS," the STRATCOM commander shouts at the video screen. Without launch codes from the president, the STRATCOM commander remains hamstrung. He waits. And just when one thinks the unfolding situation could not get any worse, new data comes in from NRO's Aerospace Data Facility in Colorado. SBIRS sensors have detected the hot rocket exhaust on a submarine-launched ballistic missile. This second attacking missile has breached the surface of the ocean, roughly 350 miles off the California coast. The only nuclear-capable missile that can get closer to its target, and therefore strike and hit a target, in this case inside the United States, faster than an ICBM launched from across the globe, is a submarine-launched ballistic missile, the dreaded SLBM. "Oh my God," someone in the bunker says. 17 minutes, Beale Air Force Base, California. 17 minutes have passed since a nuclear-capable ICBM lifted up off a dirt field in Pyongsong, North Korea, headed for the east coast of the United States. Now, an early warning satellite in high Earth orbit tracks this second ballistic missile as it moves through boost phase toward California. There is little data to discern who owns this missile or the submarine it was launched from, not now, not in real time. But everyone's best guess is North Korea. Satellites do not have eyes under the sea. Submarines hide under ocean cover, rise close to the surface, fire their missiles, and disappear. Analysts at Beale Air Force Base outside Yuba City, California, acquire, track, and confirm this second event as a ballistic missile moving at hypersonic speed. Generals and admirals at underground control centers in Colorado, Nebraska, and Washington, D.C. no longer hold facial expressions at neutral. So many of them thinking, even saying out loud, similarly shocking truths. One missile could be a misread. Two is not a mistake. Deterrence has failed. Nuclear war is happening now. Most of them knowing this is the beginning of the end of the world. One incoming attacking missile could be a terrible